In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. The age of the Redcoats, from the Civil War to the Victorian era, was an extraordinary period of British military history. Led by celebrated figures such as General Wolfe and the Duke of Wellington, Britain's army became the world's foremost military power. So how exactly did this come about? Here, in conversation with Spencer Mizzen, leading military historian Saul David answers your questions on the history of the Redcoats.
So, Saul, we're here today to talk about the age of the British Redcoats. Now, I wonder if we could start by explaining to our listeners what exactly we mean by this term. Who were the Redcoats? Which period in British history are we talking about here?
We're really talking the 17th to the 19th century, but specifically, I suppose, the great age of the Redcoat was the start of the modern British Army, which was 1661, moving all the way to Waterloo in 1815. In actual fact, of course, Redcoats were worn for most of the rest of the 19th century, but that was really the heyday of what you would describe the period of the Redcoat. Who were the Redcoats? Well, they were mainly infantry. There were some cavalry who also wore the Redcoat, but it was chiefly infantry fighting during that period.
And that leads us to a question which has been submitted on social media by Eric A. Blair, and that is, why red? I mean, what inspired that distinctive uniform?
Well, red was first worn, actually, a fair bit earlier than this by royal troops when the Tudors created the Yeomans. So we remember them today, of course, in the Tower of London. The Yeomen of the Guard and the Yeoman Warders were created in 1485. So that's the 15th century. And the reason they wore red is because it was the Tudor colour, red and gold. Red was also worn, interesting enough, during the English Civil War on both sides, believe it or not, Spencer, and again by parliamentarian troops during the 1650s. The New Model Army wore red coats. So there was a tradition of British soldiers wearing red coats, but it was only really the creation of the English Standing Army in 1661 that the red coat was worn by all the infantry in that army.
So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the origins of the Redcoats. When and why did they emerge and how did they differ from what had gone before?
I suppose you'd have to go to the date 1661 when the modern British Army is created. It's created by Charles II as a bodyguard and he creates the Foot and Horse Guards and they are all clothed in red coats. So this is really the origins of the red coat. As the English army expands, and later, of course, the British army from 1707, you get all the infantry, not just the foot guards and the horse guards, wearing red, and also some of the cavalry too. Light cavalry generally did not wear red, they wore blue. But you've got a big chunk of what becomes the British army wearing red coats, which is where, of course, the name comes from.
Now, I wonder if I could kind of turn to the sort of geopolitical situation in Europe at this moment, because in the second half of the 17th century, I believe that France is seen as having Europe's most powerful army, and under King Louis XIV had designs on dominating the continent. How did the British army in this period set about catching up with the French and sort of seeing off and dealing with that French challenge?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? If you think that from the creation of the modern British army, and particularly after the Glorious Revolution in 1688, the English army at that point is only 20,000 strong. And the French army, as you say, the French army of Louis XIV is really the dominant force on the continent. But you've got a series of innovations, reforms of the army, also financial reforms, and the arrival of arguably the greatest commander in English and British history, and that's the Duke of Marlborough, all happening pretty much at the same time, all happening in the 1690s. So there are various key reforms in the 1690s, particularly in terms of weapons. What you've got is the move from the old matchlock to flintlocks. This was a much more secure way of firing a musket. You also had the arrival of bayonets for the first time. And what the bayonet allowed is for an infantryman to act both as a musketeer, but also as a pikeman. Before this period, you really had these two separate groups. Now you had one guy who could do both jobs. And you also had, as I say, Spencer, the arrival of the Duke of Marlborough, who was going to be not only a fine battlefield tactician, but also a great strategist. He was a trainer of men. He was an innovator. He introduced the cart, the two-wheel cart that allowed his armies to move faster than any of the other European armies. And he was a great logistician. So this was a man who really had all the abilities you would require in a great commander, including that intangible quality, Spencer, which was known as Clausewitz, the great military theorist, as coup d'oeil, the ability to notice in the midst of a battle, in the midst of all the crisis of combat, the key moment when you need to act. And there's, of course, the finest victory that Marlborough wins in 1704 at the Battle of Blenheim. There was this crucial moment in the midst of the battle where he decided to move a force of not just infantry, but also cavalry and artillery against the center of the French and Bavarian line. And this was the key moment. It forces the breakthrough and it forces this huge and successful battlefield victory. The first one for generations, because generally speaking, up to that point, most wars were won by sieges and the raising of sieges and successful sieges. But this was a battlefield success, the first huge battlefield success in Europe since the 1630s. And this was all down to Marlborough's ability, but also to the reforms in the army and, crucially, financial reforms, which gave him the money to be able to win this war.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Yeah, talking about the financial reforms, can you tell us a little more about those? How much did they change the picture for the British Army and its ability to wage war on the continent?
Well, in the 1690s, when Marlborough first comes into play as a general, the English army is financed by government revenue, of course, like all armies, but that government revenue is finite. And of course, the wars of the early 1690s were costing more than the government had in revenue. So it introduced a new system of financing wars, and this was known as exchequer bills. So exchequer bills were basically a promise that the government would pay a percentage, it was about 10%, I think, was initially offered, on future revenue. And this was a real game changer. A couple of years after that, of course, the Bank of England is instituted, and this gives Britain a financial stability and an ability to borrow money in extraordinary times like war that meant it could pay for conflict not only for its own army, but also hire other troops from other nations. And this really became the British way of warfare for the next couple of centuries, in fact, on to the current day, because it enabled Britain to be much more nimble in terms of its financing of its military force.
And the British forces would have been involved increasingly in theatres across the globe. I mean, how did they manage to deal with that challenge of being in action across continents?
Well, what you generally got, Spencer, in times of great conflicts, and the English army, later the British army, is involved in the three great conflicts of the period that I've been speaking about, which is 1661 to 1815. That's the War of the Spanish Succession, the Seven Years' War, and the Napoleonic Wars. And in times of these big conflicts, the army tends to expand, and is able to do so because of the financial flexibility the government exchequer has to borrow money in times of emergency. And so what you get during these periods is the army recruiting, expanding, and also, as I say, hiring mercenaries so that it becomes a force that can fight all around the globe, but also particularly on the continent where the real key battles take place in all of those great conflicts.
At this point, what kind of status did being a redcoat, being in the British Army, confer? Was this a prize job among the British people, or were they kind of seen as, you know, the lowest and lower scum of the earth?
Well, it really depends whether you're an ordinary soldier or an officer. I mean, if you're an ordinary soldier during the whole of this period on into the 19th century and really until the 20th century, to be truthful, Spencer, when, of course, the whole nation is in arms in the two world wars. But up to that period, the ordinary soldier tended to come from the urban and agricultural poor. Pay was pretty low, 8 pence for most of this period a week, and that goes up to a shilling a week. And this was a relatively small amount of money. And even that tiny amount of money was made smaller because money was taken out for equipment and also for food. So it really was just eking out a living at the sort of very basic level. And that's why people tended to come from these pretty deprived backgrounds. They were actually quite tough characters and they made very good soldiers. But on the other hand, you had the officers and they came from completely the other side of the social spectrum. They tended to come from the wealthy middle classes and upper classes. And the reason only people from those sort of backgrounds could become officers is because for most of this period, right up until 1870, when it was abolished, there was something known as the purchase system, which effectively meant you had to buy your commission. And that ensured that only people with a vested interest in the status quo, people of property and people of wealth, could become officers. And this was felt to be, you know, not only would you get the right educated, capable people into the armed forces as officers, they would also have an interest in, as I say, keeping the status quo. So you would have political stability as well. I mean, remember, all through this period, one of the big fears of the governing classes is that the military might try to take over, as of course they had done with Cromwell during the dictatorship of the 1650s. So there was a determination that the army would remain outside politics. And one of the ways to do that was by making sure that the officers, the leaders of the army, came, as I say, from this class that had a vested interest in the status quo.
Now, that doesn't strike me as being particularly meritocratic. Did that hold back the army in any way? Did that stymie its performance? And did that change over the period in which we're talking about here?
Well, it did change, actually, over the period. I mean, there was a belief by some people argued during the whole of this period that actually, of course, this just meant that the army wouldn't be meritocratic. You would have very wealthy people able to buy commissions. And there were a lot of scandals, actually. And you get these extraordinary situations where even some of the very capable commanders like Wolfe would become battalion commanders in their young 20s. And this was felt that if you're just going to allow people with wealth and interest to get to these relatively high positions, it was a bit of a problem. Well, there were a couple of safeguards against that. One of them was that you couldn't buy a commission beyond lieutenant colonel. So as soon as you went to, you know, brigadier or major general status, that had to be a selection process. Now, admittedly, it was often based on how long you'd served for, but nevertheless, there was an opportunity to get the right people into the right positions for senior command. And slowly but surely during this period, there were some reforms that made the system a little bit more meritocratic. During the Napoleonic Wars, for example, a number of key reforms instituted by His Royal Highness the Duke of York, who was the commander-in-chief, meant that you couldn't become an officer at a ridiculously young age. You had to be a minimum of 16 for the junior officer status. And then to be promoted to the next rank, captain, and then on to major, you had to have served for a certain number of time. He also introduced what became the very effective Staff College, but also Sandhurst, which meant there was professional training for officers. This was in the early 19th century during the Napoleonic Wars. They were originally known as the junior and senior departments. And this gave at least a modicum of professional training for officers and meant that they really knew what they were doing. Later on, in 1870, the purchase system is abolished and the whole system becomes a little bit more meritocratic, although it still was partly predicated on who you knew and how much money you had, how much influence, frankly, you had. I think it's probably fair to say, though, Spencer, that in wartime, a lot of these barriers broke down, certainly in the Napoleonic Wars, in some of the elite regiments like the Rifles. You had people from much lower social status becoming officers. You had people promoted on the battlefield. So there was an element of meritocracy, and the army was a little bit more flexible in its command structure than it might have appeared from the outside.
Britain in this period is very much seen as a naval power whose global empire was built on the brilliance of the Royal Navy. I mean, did soldiers at the time feel that they were living in the shadow of the Navy? Do you think that the role of the army in this period is sometimes underappreciated?
Yeah, I do. I mean, the Royal Navy played an absolutely vital role, as we know, during the whole of this period. It, of course, protected sea lanes. It helped to launch amphibious attacks and it opened up new areas of trade. But you also needed the army to fight on land. Only a land force as professional, flexible, and effective as the British Army could have won these three great conflicts that I talked about. Now, during the whole of this period, there was a debate over strategy. Were you going to follow, which as the Navy wanted to do, a maritime strategy, which really meant that you would launch amphibious operations, you would take care of trade, as I've explained, but you wouldn't fight in major conflicts on the continent? Or would you actually need what was known as a continental commitment? And it's interesting that even our finest naval historian, N.A.M. Roger, has written the quote, "As to armies on the continent, it is unquestionable that a continental victory requires a continental commitment." So that continental commitment, of course, is the Redcoats. And without their contribution in all these wars that I've mentioned, but particularly in the Peninsula and at Waterloo, Britain could not have won ultimately its war of survival against Napoleon and become by 1815 the dominant imperial and maritime power in the world. So really, they both deserve credit. The Royal Navy, generally speaking, had more money spent on it, but the army played and the Redcoats played this absolutely crucial role too.
Now, so the big personalities in this period, the people who did the most to shape the trajectory of the British Army between the late 17th and early 19th century. You've mentioned Marlborough. I wonder if you could introduce us to a couple more heavyweight figures that we really need to know about from this era.
Yeah, well, they would have to be Wolfe and the Duke of Wellington. I mean, if we look at the great commanders in British history, these three would be up there. You know, you might add Slim, and going back to the medieval period, you'd probably have Henry V and Edward I and one or two others. I've mentioned Marlborough, but if we move on to Wolfe, it's very interesting that you see some of the same similarities and some of the same talents. He was an innovator, a great trainer of men. He was the son of soldiers. His father was a major general. Both his grandfather and great-grandfather also came from military background. He became a battalion commander at just 23, but he also introduced innovations like Marlborough before him that were absolutely crucial on the battlefield. So what were they? Well, there was this system of platoon firing. I mean, basically, the British Army became very successful in battle during the whole of the Redcoat period because it fought in just three ranks. And in those three ranks, it was able to both attack and defend. Now, what Wolfe was able to do is make the army much more aggressive. And he did this by two things. He created something called the alternate fire system, which was a firing drill actually based on a Prussian model, which used companies firing together in blocks rather than platoons as it had been before, which enabled them to deliver a much heavier weight of fire. But he also did something else, which would go on all the way through this period, and you can argue is still sort of relevant to the British Army today. And that's introduced the idea of using the bayonet in an aggressive sense. Previously, from the Marlborough period, it had been used as a kind of defensive weapon like pikes to stop cavalry attacks, but also to be used against infantry. But what Wolfe realized is that actually, once you fired your weapon, and of course, it took a fair while to load muskets at this period, you could advance very aggressively with the bayonet and use that alone to take positions. And probably these two innovations are used in their most effective sense at Wolfe's greatest victory, which of course was outside Quebec in 1759, the battle that ultimately wins Canada for the British. Now, tragically, Wolfe dies in that battle, and so we'll never know how good a commander he could have become. He was just 32 years old, but already he had shown all the talent and introduced these vital innovations to be judged, I think, one of the greatest commanders of the period. And Wellington, of course, is the third great commander of this period. I mean, his battlefield victories are pretty well known, but what is probably less well known is how seriously he took the business of soldiering. We discussed earlier, Spencer, you know, the idea that some people could buy their commissions, and that's exactly what happened with Wellington. His brother bought his first commission and then bought promotion. So he was promoted to battalion commander at a pretty early age. But at the same time, as well as having this privilege, he was also determined to become the best soldier he could be. He goes out to India in the 1790s and takes a sort of sack full of books with him about military theory, about military history. So he really wanted to learn the business. But also he showed from a very early stage the ability to train men, to enthuse them, to plan battles. He was a brilliant logistician, as indeed all these people were. You know, the ability to get an army to fight at the right place with the right kit and enough food to get them there well enough so that they could perform as effectively as they could. All of these things are absolutely crucial in a battlefield commander. And the Duke of Wellington has this in spades. He's a brilliant battlefield commander, as I say, a series of victories in India, the peninsula, and culminating at Waterloo. Arguably not the greatest strategist. That's when you piece together all the battles and the operations into an overall whole. What's it all for and how does it all fit together? But as a battlefield commander, he was almost without equal and certainly was Marlborough's equal in that sense. And I think the English army as it was and the British army as it became was incredibly lucky to have these three great commanders who, you know, would stand the test among any in the history of warfare during this relatively small period. I mean, it's astonishing. And there were others, of course, but these three stand out.
And if you could identify, I mean, I know you've obviously mentioned quite a few battlefield victories before in our chat, but if you could identify three that we really need to know about from this period, what would they be?
Yeah, well, I've mentioned Blenheim, of course, which was the finest victory that Marlborough achieved and the first great victory on European soil for about 70 or 80 years. And that's in 1704. Interestingly enough, though, Spencer, it doesn't win the War of the Spanish Succession. And some people feel that when the War of the Spanish Succession is finally over in 1714, when the peace treaty is made, it's sort of inconclusive. It's not really a great victory for Britain. In reality, it was, because the only gainer from the War of the Spanish Succession is Britain, certainly in terms of consolidating its position in the world and its colonial position. And it's really when Britain takes over the mantle of being the most successful force on the battlefield from the French. And that is chiefly down to Marlborough, and it's chiefly down to the Battle of Blenheim. There were many other victories won, of course, by Marlborough, including Ramillies and Oudenarde and a number of others. But I would say Blenheim at that period. And then you move on and it would have to be Quebec in 1759. Wolfe's victory at Quebec was an astonishing achievement against the odds at the end of very long supply lines after a long climb up a cliff. everything was against him. And if he hadn't won that day, it would have been an utter disaster. He, of course, dies in the midst of victory. But nevertheless, that victory is the keystone for what becomes the takeover of Canada by the British, and hugely important in terms of the expansion of our empire. And the third one, of course, it's hackneyed, I know, Spencer, but it has to be Waterloo, which is the termination of the Napoleonic Wars, the end of Napoleon, and really sets the scene for Britain being the dominant maritime and industrial power in the world at that time, a mantle that's not really passed on to the Americans until the 20th century. So it would have to be those three great victories.
And what about on the other side of the coin? What about the reversals, the setbacks, the battles of which the Redcoats possibly wouldn't have been so proud of in retrospect? So I wonder if you just give us a couple of examples of those.
Yeah, I mean, there were many setbacks during this period. I mean, it's interesting that the old saying that Britain often loses a victory at the beginning of the war, but wins the war. And you get this in many of these conflicts. I mean, at the start of the little known or relatively little known War of the Austrian Succession, you know, there are a number of setbacks for the British at Lauffeld and Fontenoy. And that's a war that's not really considered to be won by the British. Again, it's effectively a draw, if anything. Probably better known, of course, are the setbacks during the American War of Independence. I mean, that goes incredibly badly, ultimately is lost, of course, by the British, and is the only war during the whole of this period that's ultimately lost. Yorktown, of course, is well known as the sort of crowning defeat that really leads to the disaster of the loss of the colonies in America. There were opportunities, interesting enough. Funny enough, that war is probably an example of things the other way around. We did have a number of victories in the early stages of that war, and there were opportunities probably to defeat the rebels, but they weren't taken. And the longer it went on, of course, the worse it got for us.
How much of a knock to British confidence and self-esteem was the loss of the American colonies?
I think it was a terrible knock to self-esteem, but also to the exchequer to a certain extent. I mean, this was a territory that was going to go on to become incredibly powerful, financially viable. And we know, obviously, it becomes the United States of the 20th century. So to lose it was a real shock to morale. We lost it, of course, partly because the American rebels had allied with the French and the Spanish, and in some ways for the French in particular, after the Seven Years' War, this was a bit of payback. So by the time you get the start of the Napoleonic Wars, we're really on our uppers. I mean, the army needs serious reform. And that's when, as I say, His Royal Highness the Duke of York, but also Wellington, play this key role in rejuvenating the army so that it ultimately is able to play a key role in winning the Napoleonic Wars. But these defeats were a shock to the system. What they tended to do, to be truthful, is encourage both administrators and senior military men that the military forces needed to be reformed. So all the way through this period, particularly after military setbacks, you get an encouragement for reform, which eventually pays dividends.
And would the Redcoats have gone into action domestically? Would they have been used in Britain as well as on foreign soil?
Yeah, we have to remember that during this period, there is no police force. I mean, the police force is created in 1829, and that's the Metropolitan Police. And prior to this, the army is used as a sort of coercive force domestically, admittedly of last resort, but it nevertheless is used. It's often called out in terms of riot, economic troubles, even disorder caused by, you know, the calls for parliamentary reform, of which there were many during this period. And I suppose the most infamous, Spencer, is in 1819, when there is a big rally in Peterloo in Manchester to demand parliamentary reform. And the yeomanry are sent in to disperse the crowd. And they actually use their blades, the blades of their swords. I mean, you know, they insist afterwards they were just intending to use the flat of their swords, but actually they use their blades, and also their horses trample a number of people underfoot. So this is a big scandal in which a lot of civilians get killed or wounded. And it reminds, I suppose, the government that using the army for this sort of thing is not necessarily a good thing. And that's one of the reasons, or one of the encouragements, for the creation of the police force. But for most of this period, it was used as a coercive force. But also, let's not forget, there were major rebellions during this period. And I'm thinking about the Jacobite rebellions in 1715 and 1745. that did need to be stamped out with force. And so the British Army fights its last set-piece battle on British soil in 1746, at the end of the 1745 rebellion, as it's known, at Culloden. And it's also used, of course, at Sedgemoor in 1785 and during some of the battles in 1715 too. So it's used in this double-edged way. Set-piece battles, they are relatively rare, to be truthful, but also as a coercive force. Not ideal for that, I have to say.
Now, Alex Plotkin asks on social media, when and why did the British Army decide to dispense with the redcoat? And when can this age be said to have come to an end?
There are a couple of key things that means the wearing the red coat is no longer viable. I should have said, Spencer, actually, that one of the reasons why the red coat is quite useful to wear is because you can see your fellow soldiers on the battlefield. I mean, it's really distinctive. It's also bright and striking and ultimately quite scary for the enemy to face you when you've got this, you know, this horde of incredibly brightly coloured soldiers coming towards you. But that distinctiveness and that visibility on the battlefield was ultimately its undoing, because by the end of the 19th century, you've got a lot of military reforms, particularly with weapons, small arms weapons. You've got smokeless powder, which means you can't see where the shots are coming from. But you've also got the introduction of rifles, magazine rifles, breech loading magazine rifles, which can then produce a quick rate of fire and they can fire from a long distance away. The first time this was an obvious problem for the British Army was in the Boer War, the Transvaal War of 1880 to 1881, when some of these weapons were already in play, but particularly the Second Boer War of 1899 to 1902. And by that time, the British Army had moved entirely from redcoats to khaki for that very reason. You can't have a whole block of soldiers moving on a battlefield in red because they're too easy to spot. And with these very effective weapons, both rifles but also machine guns by this point, they could be mowed down quite easily. So you need to blend in with the scenery, and that's when khaki comes in. And it's pretty much effectively still used today.
And finally, Sars, a question we've had submitted on social media. What would you say is the legacy of the redcoats? How did this period shape the modern British Army? Are there many legacies within our armed forces today from that period in British military history?
Well, certainly the British Army today looks back at this period, not so much as the heyday, but really the sort of founding block of what it became, both in terms of discipline and training, but also its ability and its flexibility on the battlefield. So the British Army is known today as an army that gets things done. When things are, you know, going pear-shaped, you send in these very well-trained soldiers who can fight, interestingly enough, Spencer, as effectively in a defensive mode as they can in an offensive mode. And of course, the modern soldier, you know, can do a lot more than that. He's a peacekeeper, he's a hearts and minds type soldier, but certainly the flexibility and the training and the stoicism and determination. I mean, even meeting British soldiers today, you realize how tough they are, you know, the sort of conditions they're prepared to fight in when it's wet, when it's cold, and they are as equally effective in all these conditions. And morale is everything in a modern army as in an ancient army. And what you can see all the way through this period is officers setting examples for their soldiers, never asking them to do things that they aren't prepared to do themselves. And the British Army has had that example really from Marlborough onwards. Marlborough was known as Corporal John, and he was given that moniker because he had a real sense of the welfare of his soldiers. And you could say that all the great commanders have this ability to at least make their soldiers think that they're interested in their welfare and saving their lives. And of course, you go on to modern days with people like Montgomery, very good communicator with the ordinary soldier. But I think that the real key relationship all the way through this period and today is the ability of the junior officer to convince his soldiers that he's not going to ask them to do anything he's not prepared to do himself. Even though there was a social disparity during the period of the red coat, this was an example that was set and it's still used today.
That was Saul David, military historian, novelist and broadcaster. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.